Oh my, where would we start on something like that?
I've got a question for you.
Uh-oh.
Okay, here's the question, the first question.
Oh, may I reinforce what Bob said, though. If you want to interrupt at any time, particularly right this second, you feel free to do so, okay? I think I would like your questions better than his.
They're probably better. Your father started in 1951 Kono Christian School. He was an amazing man. In fact, I've told you this before. I met him before I met you because he was on the board of the Seminary Covenant when I was there in 1970. But he was Kuiperian before Kuiperian became cool.
He was Kuiperian before Kuiper was.
And he was, if not the pioneer, then one of the pioneers of conservative Presbyterian K-12 education in America, long before Covenant College and Covenant Seminary. Tell us a little bit about Max and Jean Bells and what animated them and what caused them to be so really quite extraordinary.
My father was a third-generation grain and lumber and coal dealer in rural Iowa, a little town called Holland, Iowa. There was strong Dutch influence there, strong German Presbyterian influence there. And it was a prosperous place to be in the grain business. I say grain, lumber, and coal because in the Midwest, those three entities were always on the railroad. Those railroads are all picked up and vanished by now. But in those days, you needed the railroads to prosper with grain and lumber and coal. And so in the late 30s and early 40s, my dad was in that business. Dad and Mom soon had the first of eight children. I have three sisters and four brothers. And it was God's providence during World War II that Dad and Mom went on Sunday mornings to a German Presbyterian church. And I say German because once every month, as I understand it, the sermon was given in German because there were so many German people there. That kind of gave way during World War II, and it was a little less patriotic to preach a sermon in German during World War II. But on Sunday evenings, my dad and mom went to a Christian Reformed church, and the pastor there was a man by the name of Peter Elversveld. Some of you older people will remember that on the Back to God Hour of the Christian Reformed Church, Peter Elversveld was the radio preacher. And his preaching was so strong and so pointed and so vigorous that Dad and Mom really had their hearts changed. And Dad decided to sell the family business in 1946 and go into the ministry himself. It was a little bit of a contradiction, I want to say, because it wasn't a rejection of a so-called secular life that prompted Dad to do that. It wasn't that he thought he was less than called to be a grain dealer. He loved that work, and he saw it as a calling from God. But he thought that it was his calling to be more explicit in terms of taking God's Word and teaching it to his family and teaching it to other people. So Dad went into the ministry in the mainline Presbyterian church in 1947, By 1948, he had discovered how liberal that denomination was. And so he decided with the elders of the church to leave the denomination and to become a Bible Presbyterian. Now, this congregation at Faith Church here in Tacoma was one of the early Bible Presbyterian churches. I remember when I think a man by the name of Roy Brumbaugh. Does that ring a bell with someone? Yeah, with someone. Yeah. He was the pastor here, was he not? Yeah. And this church was not known for what it has become known for now, but we've always looked to Faith Church in Tacoma as one of the leaders in. And then Bill McCauley was in this church. What years? He grew up in the church. Bill was my older roommate during my freshman year of college. Now, I just want to say one thing about my dad, because tells you why he felt he needed to be committed to Christian education. My dad would go and throw open the door on a sunny morning, and he'd say, "Just look at the sunshine God has given us today." And that simple little statement, friends, was all-inclusive so far as I was concerned, because what it did was it rooted your conversation for the day in God's handiwork. The reason World Magazine has the name World is that several years before that, and I don't want to get ahead of you here, but several years before that, we had started to make several magazines for children, and the children's magazines, the first one was called It's God's World. It's God's World got its name from Psalm 24:1, which I heard my dad recite again and again and again. The earth is the Lord's, the world is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and all that dwell therein. And that is the theme, that was the theme I was brought up on. Didn't matter what we did, my dad kept pulling it back toward the centrality of God in his universe.
Okay, to follow up, Max and Jean Bells started this movement of Christian education. Now there are multitude of Reformed Presbyterian schools around the country, including here in Tacoma at Faith Presbyterian. Our daughters go to one, granddaughters go to one in Seattle. But still, there are a large measure of disinterest in Christian education on a large part of the Christian church. We are somewhat unique at Faith because we have an understanding, but not everyone does. Why? Why is not the church, with a capital C, completely supportive of Christian education?
Oh my. May I be bold and say what is what comes first to my mind, and I hope it doesn't change. But I have to tell you, I think it's because of the cost. Very candidly, I think it's because of the cost. We pay for what we value most, and I think that the cost of Christian education has become so high that many people just say, "I cannot do that. I want it." Now, some do not see the importance of it. Some do not see the value of it. But I would say, by and large, that, and I don't say this with delight. I say it with pain. I think the cost has become so high. It was high to begin with in various, the cost is high in several different ways. When I say the cost, I know that many of you will say, "Oh, he's talking about money," and I am. It is an expensive commitment to address yourself to a school like the one that this church has associated with it. It was expensive, but it couldn't have been too expensive when we started because we didn't pay the teachers very much. So that was certainly true on the one hand, but it's costly in another sense, and that is people are not persuaded, by and large, that they will get the quality of education from a Christian school that they get from the state of schools or perhaps other private schools. And people have been unwilling to pay that cost. Now, I'm here partly as a spokesman for Christian education to say, if that's you, then please look again. Because I would say emphatically let me go back to the years when my mom and dad founded Kono Christian School out in Iowa. They did hear people say, "Max, Gene, are you really going to do this with your children? Your children have gifts and they can grow up and do great things, but they're not going to be able to do them if you send them to this little podunk school." Now, when I say little podunk school, I mean... And I have a smiling face out here because she knows, Pat Perkins. It was the fellowship hall of the little church that my dad was pastoring. And that fellowship hall, I can tell you, was exactly 20 feet by 36 feet. And there were 7 students in that school the very first year. And we had one teacher. I should say, if we were doing it these days, we would have called it homeschooling. But we didn't know that then. And so we had one teacher for seven students, and some of the students were in seventh grade, and the youngest ones were in kindergarten. And that was the school that Mom and Dad said was going to be good enough for their kids. Well, it was. It was more than we needed, and it challenged us to keep growing. But I do have to say this. That school room was right next door to our house. And it was, you opened one door and you went from our kitchen into this fellowship hall. So education was important to me, but down the steps, right at that same doorway, Dad installed a little print shop. And so we learned the power of the printed page too. We learned literally how to set type. We had a Linotype machine there. And we learned how to get thoughts onto the printed page. So I grew up with a strong emphasis on education on the one hand, Dad and Mom's commitment, no matter what the cost, to education, and the commitment to the printed page. And I have to tell you that to this day, I haven't really sorted out exactly which my calling is, education or publishing.
If you are thinking about Christian education, which is more important, K through 6 or high school?
Wow. You know, the Roman Catholics for years and years said, give us a child until he's 8 years old, and you can do whatever you want with him the rest of the time. I don't know where that came from originally. There was some wisdom to it. I certainly would be emphatic that the earlier the better. I think that is clearly the case. But I hate to have to make the choice. I did used to put more emphasis on the elementary grades than on the high school. Now I kind of think the high school years are critically important because those are the years when students tend to begin rejecting things. Little kids, young elementary kids, don't consciously reject certain things the way high school kids tend to reject. And it becomes kind of cachet to reject. So I want to hang on tight to the kids during the high school years. But then the same thing can be said during college. American higher education has absolutely stolen the heart of the evangelical church. On so many fronts, and we've got to see the importance of Christ-centered curriculum on the college level.
Well, let's pursue that because the PCA is famous, particularly in the Southeast, for thinking that Alabama and Auburn are
and Clemson are
as Christian as Covenant.
Yeah.
So explain why that mindset is that we can send our children into the jaws of hell in college, but keep them close to us in high school and preschool.
Well, I should acknowledge with delight and with thanksgiving that one of the primary ministries of the Presbyterian Church in America for the last 25 years has been the work of Reformed University Fellowship, RUF, on several hundred campuses across the United States. And I think that's a marvelous and wonderful gift from the Lord that ministry is there. At the same time, I would say that the truths that RUF takes into the lives of willing students, and folks, you need to know, if you're not aware of what RUF has done this way, at some major universities, I'm not familiar with RUF here in the Pacific Northwest, but for instance, at Vanderbilt University or the University of Alabama that you just mentioned or University of Tennessee. Those RUF was born in the South as the Presbyterian Church in America was born in the South. But some of those campuses have RUF groups of 300 and 400 and 500 students meeting every single week. It's a remarkable thing because they have left in the dust general evangelical ministries like InterVarsity Christian Fellowship or Campus Crusade or other organizations like that. So it's I want to give high credit to what RUF is doing. But then I say, if they are taking the basic doctrine of the church and making it palatable and understandable for college-age students, if they are able to do that in 3 or 4 hours each week of the student's time, just think what is possible in the 30 or 40 hours per week that Covenant College has available to it to do the same thing. And so I would say, hey, why settle for second best if you can get the best? And I still put my vote with the full-time energy that the faculty at Covenant College has compared to the terrific openings that RUF has.
Historic events happening this weekend when your grandson, the great-grandson of the founder, perhaps the first great-grandson of one of the founders of Covenant College, is graduating. Can you speak to that?
Well, it gives me great delight. Carol and I have 5 daughters and 16 grandchildren, and a number of them have gone to Covenant, out of the whole mix. But we are thrilled that our oldest grandson, whose parents live in Cheyenne, Wyoming, is that about halfway between here and home? I think it must be. Yeah. Still made his way back to Lookout Mountain. Yeah, so we're thankful for that.
How do you address the financial impact?
Oh, you did have to bring it back to dollars, didn't you? Yeah. Boy, I think it's one of the main things we have to address, whether it's with your school here associated with this church, all the way up through Covenant College. It is a major challenge. And I know from personal experience, I can look out on a group like you and know that whether it's your involvement in your school here or perhaps with a Christian college for your children or your family, I know that some of you are what I call myself, education poor. My wallet is not as thick as it would have been if Carol and I had not committed to Christian education. We still think it's an important part of our lives. And it's when we think about various investments, it's one of the investments we are happiest we have made. Because if for no other reason, the promises of the Lord are implicit in that education, and when rough times come for our kids, as they will come, hard choices, unwise decisions, all sorts of things like that. When those times come, the Lord is there deep in the recesses of their minds and hearts to remind them of His promises and the things that He says are true. So we have, even when the evil one comes and says, "You sure you should have done that?" Yeah, we say, yeah, we're still sure. And then we pray that the Lord will indeed honor His covenant promises. But I want to say, after saying all that, that I think there are practical things that the establishment of these different schools, some of you are probably on the school board here or the faculty or just other decision-making positions. I'll give you an idea. I did hear, I had opportunity a couple months ago to speak at a Christian school in the Grand Rapids area. And that school opened last year after taking the place of a Christian school that had just gone bankrupt. So it does happen. This was Freedom Christian School. It had been for 30 years in West Grand Rapids, a broadly evangelical school, and they went bankrupt. They simply didn't have good enough care in the leadership of the school. Well, the new school, Libertas Christian School, is taking its place, and they are trying to learn from the mistakes of the other school. And one of the things they are doing is to say, come one, come all, and we guarantee you that no family who patronizes our school will have to pay more than 10% of their family income to send a student here, or to send a whole family of students. the leadership of this school, and there's some smart businessmen are saying, we think that if the Lord says the tithe is 10%, well, we don't want to charge more than that. A little bit whimsical, but I'm not sure it's teaching that you could take all the way. But it's a good guideline. And so they are saying no family is going to have to pay more than 10% of its annual income to send their students to this school. That bears some watching. Will they be able to make it? I hope they don't have a second bankruptcy waiting for them. But as I say, they are trying seriously to learn from their mistakes. And I think that if the leadership of our schools could find some basic principles like that and honor them, it would be a good thing.
Change gears just a little bit. The denomination that your father and Dr. Rayburn, J. Oliver Buswell, Francis Schaeffer started in the mid-50s has provided a home for wayward Christians like my family. The school they started provided education for my daughters. Seminaries provided education for me. So the Bells family, the Rayburn family, the Buswell family, Schaeffer family, etc., provided really a place of nesting for so many in this congregation. And then we joined the PCA, bringing along colleges and seminaries and established mission agencies that your father and others had started. How has that union worked? And has the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod, the smaller group of the two, has those distinctives enhanced the greater denomination that's been united?
Hmm.
You were the moderator of the whole shebang.
Yeah, so much for that. I have said since serving as moderator, what, Carol, dozen years ago, something like that. I don't know if any of you have been at a PCA General Assembly, but typically there are about 1,500 delegates, commissioners, 1,500 elders out there in this big civic auditorium. And as you stand there, you try to look out and see, because there are microphones out there in this big sea of faces, microphones out there that like microphone 8 is back here and microphone 12 is over here, and you try to keep some order and say, I want to recognize the delegate at microphone 7. But you're not quite sure if you can see because the light is all coming this way, see, toward the platform. And the sound is all going out this way, so you can't quite hear what's going out.
You can't see and you can't hear.
That's right. And then up and down, here you've got a stated clerk, and here you have a timekeeper, and here you have a parliamentarian, and here you have a water boy. And so you've got all these things. I decided that the only person really competent to serve as a moderator is a 26-year-old mom who multitasks all day anyway. But that doesn't fly too well in the PCA. Oh. So how is it working, you ask? Now you know how it's working. Just barely. Well, let me suggest to you that in the Lord's scheme of things, it seems so often, and if you take several of these facets of church history that Bob just alluded to, it is so often the case that we try to rebuild something. We try to build something that we hope will become a positive influence, but we build it on the ruins of something that was negative, something that's very broken. And so Dr. Rayburn and my father and others were building on the ruins of the mainline Presbyterian denomination back in the 30s and the 40s when Machen and others in the north and then later some in the south decided to leave and form a conservative denomination. But it was always, we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. We want to do it right. Well, I hope that our schools can move quickly toward something that is positive, that we can move toward something that is not just pointing people at what was broken. This is just a little bit of fun, but I think it helps make the point. I do this often when I speak at schools across the country, because it tells you, for example, it suggests to you why we try to teach math the way we try to teach it today. We try to do it positively. Is there a math teacher here in this group? Nowhere. See, that tells you something. Okay. And anyway, this just summarizes how we have taught math or tried to teach it through the years. And it's a picture. Well, I'll come back to that. This summarizes how the teaching of math progressed over the last half century. Half a century ago, if you opened a math book to that section where there were thought questions, you know, not computation questions, but ones that you had to think through, it would go like this. A logger sells a truckload of lumber for $100. His cost of production is 4/5 the price. What is his profit? Have you got that one figured out?
Half the math teacher.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. 10 or 12 years later, the math books were revised. So instead of asking the question that way, it was like this. A logger sells a truckload of lumber for $100. His cost of production is 4/5 of the price. In other words, $80. What is his profit? Yeah. But we learned, you know, there was something called new math out there that we needed to teach our kids. Did you have to teach your kids new math? I wasn't smart enough to do it, but here's how the new math books put it. A logger exchanges set L of lumber for set M of money. The cardinality of set M is 100, and each element is worth $1. Make 100 dots representing the elements of set M. The set C of costs contains 20 fewer points than set M. Represent set C as a subset of set M and answer the following question. What is the cardinality of the set P of profits? Awful, isn't it? No wonder. Yeah. Well, by the late 80s, we had grown to the place where we did it like this. A logger sells a truckload of wood for $100. His cost of production is $80. His profit is $20. Your assignment, underline the number 20. But by the end of the 90s,
it gets worse.
By cutting down beautiful forest trees, a logger makes $20. What do you think of this way of making a living? Topic for class discussion. How did the forest birds and squirrels feel about it?
Okay. You're in the right state for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But see, that's what I mean when I say, now, we all laugh, and we wince, too, because we know about that track from something that's broken to something that's whole again, don't we? And we want to build something that's positive. We don't just want to build on the ashes of what is past. So I suggest to you, yeah, let's establish some long range and some medium range and some short range goals to produce what our preacher this morning referred to as the commitment to discipleship. We don't just want to pick up broken pieces and hand them to our kids and say, don't do it this way. That's not good enough. There have got to be some big goals, some big assignments that we take seriously together. And I hope that's what our Christian education enterprise, whether it's at the kindergarten level next door here, or the junior high level next door, the high school, senior high level, or the college level, either through Covenant College or RUF or some other strong efforts on the campuses. That's what we need to have strong, positive goals.
Are you positive about the future of Christian education in general and a place like Covenant College in particular?
Well, I'm certainly more optimistic. I think Covenant College, some Covenant graduates come to me and say, "Oh, I just wish for the good old days. I long for the good old days." And I say, "No, these are the good old days. I think these are the best days in the history of Covenant College." And I want to say to your congregation, thank you for sharing your pastor with Covenant College. Now, it's true. It's been a unique relationship because his father, whom I knew pretty well, his father was the founding president. And so we all have a commitment and a debt to the Rayburn family for that. But I know you have allowed him time and time again to take time off from his duties here and to invest himself at Covenant College. And Covenant College would not be the strong institution it is today without Rob Rayburn's... There are some ways I would even say emphatically, Rob has been gifted by God to commit to give more to Covenant College than his father did. And that's saying a good bit. But I'll give you a specific example of why I see Rob Rayburn as critical. He has either been on what's called the Academic Affairs Committee, or he has chaired that committee. And I think Covenant College is unique among all colleges I am aware of in that no one gets on the faculty. No one gets a faculty appointment at Covenant College without being interviewed by members of the board, not just members of the administration, but members of the board of directors, and specifically by that committee, that Academic Affairs Committee. And Rob Rayburn has been a stickler on that particular committee, so that the bar has been high, and sometimes we've had to pick up people who tried to jump over that bar and couldn't make it. We had to pick them up, dust them off, and say thank you anyway. And we're grateful to have a man like your pastor to help us do that faithfully. So that's why I am optimistic right now. But the record is not good, folks. The record isn't good. The record is that even those institutions like Covenant College or like the school that you all have here, a generation from now, they may well not be faithful. And you need to pray that they be faithful. You need to pray that they not slip and slide and go down the chute into secular oblivion.
Go ahead.
May I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely.
Well, I think you're right, and I would back off and say there's a concern I have that comes even a little bit before that. I do not see in the church at large young people stepping forward and saying, "Here am I, use me." Young men in particular ready to take on the disciplines that it's going to require for them to serve in the office of deacon and elder, and some called to other offices on the teaching side of the church. I see fewer and fewer young people and young women, fewer young women stepping forward saying, "Here I am. How can you use me?" So even before we come to the issue of faithfulness to the standards of our church and our educational institutions, do we have people who just are ready to be leaders? And I see a certain weakness in our corporate bodies among people willing to do that. Then we have to answer the question you have. And I think our only answer is the Lord's got His people. We just have to figure out a way to identify them.
Go ahead.
Well, I have to tell you, and you all must know this, but the public school system is broken now in ways that it simply wasn't in a generation ago. I mean, the breakage has been underway for many decades. Are you saying it's about time to?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, I just wanted to make
sure.
I let me say first, I see a little sequence. In the 1950s, when my parents first went into Christian education, I think the typical response of evangelical parents, and now I'm not just speaking in Presbyterianism, but evangelical Christians across the board, the typical response was, oh, let's just do a good job in the public schools. If we join the PTAs, if we jump in and try to get Christian teachers hired here and there and that sort of thing, things are going to turn out okay. They may not be exactly what we want, but, well, then more and more through the 50s and the 60s began to say, no, it's not that rosy a picture. That's not going to make a big enough difference. We are going to have Christian schools. And so I'd say the 60s and the 70s on into the 80s was the grand time of the growth of the Christian school movement. And I remember often hearing people say then, there's a new Christian school being formed somewhere in the United States every single week. A net of 52 new Christian schools every year. And that, I'd say, characterized those times. Well, then something unusual happened. The homeschool movement came along. It wasn't that nobody had homeschooled before. Abraham Lincoln was homeschooled. But there were, all of a sudden, that caught fire. When we started publishing the God's World magazines for children, in 1981, we didn't know what a homeschooler was. And then I remember a homeschooling family joined our church in Asheville, North Carolina, and they had to fight being arrested, even that recently. Well, homeschool movement has flourished since then. And I say, just as a matter of fact, not pointing a finger or anything like that, but the homeschool movement has been one of the great challenges to the Christian school movement, because so many good people who were gifted leaders in the Christian school movement quietly moved to the homeschool movement. And I mean, we saw that in our own church with some of our very best friends. And that's why I'm not saying, I'm certainly not condemning them. I'm just saying, as a matter of fact, that took a lot of the leader and some of the financial well-being of the Christian school movement moved to the homeschool movement. And now then the homeschool movement began to learn, hey, we can do better forming alliances and forming groups among ourselves. And that was a wholesome and healthy thing, and it promoted positive thinking about cooperation and working together. And now I'd say the most recent movement has been, and keep in mind, being faithful leaders within the public school movement, Christian schools, homeschools, and now I'd say, and homeschool alliances. Now I would say the classical Christian school movement. I don't know if you have a classical school, or is this school somewhat classical? In any case, the classical school movement has now had its day. I don't know what's next, because I think we do continue to experiment. Maybe the free enterprise Christian school movement, something like that. But we need somebody to step up and say, hey, we'll help make it work. There was a name, yeah.
Joel, do you have any idea why certain denominations historically are more associated and involved in Christian education?
Like the Christian Reformed and the Lutheran and the Roman Catholics.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, when my dad and mom started the school in Iowa, it was the only Presbyterian school in Iowa. I mean, Presbyterians have not been notable for doing it on the elementary or secondary level. They have always been strong in the college and certainly the seminary level. That's why Princeton Princeton probably was in a class by itself, but I know that enrollment in Lutheran schools, and for that matter, in Catholic schools, has been like this in the last generation. Catholic schools depended very, very much for millennia, well, I would say for centuries. They depended on cheap labor. They were able to have devoted nuns and devoted others invest themselves in the school. And I would say the Christian school movement in evangelicalism owes its survival through the 50s, 60s, and 70s to cheap labor. The biggest donors to Christian schools anywhere are the faculty. And I mean big donors. If you assume, and this is fair to assume, that typical Christian school teachers earn somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 less every year than their counterparts in public schools, well, my, if I were headmaster of a Christian school and I had a little group of people over here that gave $15,000 a year each, I'd take them out to dinner. And we're too cheap to do that sometimes with our own faculties. We ask them to come to dinner and bring their food.
Not a covenant, though.
No. I think, you know, folks, we are living in an age unlike any that America has certainly known. Carol and I come to you this week from North Carolina, and we don't know whether to hang our heads or say, cheer for us, because North Carolina is in zany straits right now. And I tell you that because I think we have to, well, at Covenant College, at our last board meeting, the administration listed about 8 or 10 threats to our future. I would say that out of those 8 or 10, six of them 7 or 8 years ago would have been unthinkable. Maybe unthinkable even 2 years ago. And now, and we in Asheville at World Magazine, we have to think about every nuance of our hiring practices, of our bathroom practices. I mean, it's zany, friends. But it simply would not be surprising to have, Bob and Kathy can tell you, they've known me long, Rob Rayburn said, I have not been a fearmonger through the years. I have refused in our publishing efforts to raise big pictures of things that ought to scare you to death. All of a sudden, I find myself, as an American, scared to death because such crazy things are going on with proposals and practices and restrictions and regulations that you simply wouldn't have thought would even be talked about a few months ago. And now, all of a sudden, here it is. So, I think we need to answer your question specifically. I think we ought to get busy, keep doing a better and better job, and do it as if we will be challenged by our government to stop doing everything anytime soon. And I didn't think I would ever have to say that in my lifetime. Well, let me answer with an emphatic no. The college does not take government aid, but yes, our students do. They are in the federal loan program and so on. Well, yeah, and so at our recent board meeting, we established a mechanism to begin exploration of ways that we can have private lending programs instead of federal government lending programs. And we hope to be, we hope to cut off the need for student participation over the next 2 or 3 years. But you're right. You're right. If the source of funds is there, then that gives them the power to regulate who we are.
One more question. Go ahead. Last question.
What do you think the role is in pulpit in promoting Christian education? And do you think pastors today are fulfilling that role?
No. I think they aren't. And I understand why. I think it's hard enough. It's hard enough to hold a congregation together in America today, because there are so many threats to the unity of God's people. And the evil one knows so well how to come in and take good things, good causes, and separate us and blow us apart because of possible disagreement about good things. I've often said that, for example, what's going on in the Boy Scout movement right now is the same thing that happened when the Presbyterian Church divided in the 1930s. There were some people who said, let's stay in and fight. Let's stay in and correct it. And others said, no, we've got to get out. It's beyond repair. And the problem is you have good people, well-intentioned people on both sides of that debate. And the same thing I'd say often happens in the debate over education. There are those who say, when you take your kids out of the public school, you're throwing in the towel and you're giving up and you're saying God can't do anything good there. And so there are people who take that point of view and others who say, no, I can't possibly offend my children by letting them be saturated with error. And both sides have a point. And then when it comes to threatening the congregation in this room, that is when we really need to pray for God's protection, that He give us the glue to stay together.
Okay, thank you, Sproul. Thank you, Joe.